Blog Talk Radio.
Get started with today's U College Sports Talk. Get our first caller on. Hey, is this Dustin here?
Hey, Colin, how you doing?
Doing pretty well. How are you?
Doing great. Getting ready for the big rivalry tonight at West Lafayette, Purdue IU, Mackey Arena.
Oh, nice. There you go. Good stuff. So you're not going to be watching the other big game, Notre Dame Duke?
No, I'm going to pass on that. I have DVR, so I may DVR it and watch it when we get back.
There you go. All right, let's bring Alex on here.
Hey, what's going on, guys?
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing good, man. How are yourself?
Pretty good. Ready for some Blog Talk Radio here. So let's jump right into it. One news item from this week, a couple days ago, was that Jeff Long was reelected for the college football chair, and that means he'll be the face that you see every Tuesday night on ESPN answering all those questions from those guys. So more than that, more than just the news item there, how do you guys think that the playoff was handled? Not just, you know, the did they get it right, we've had all those questions, but how do you think it was handled from the fan perspective in terms of how they got information to the fans? It was this big fanfare that we had every Tuesday night on ESPN, pretty much the middle of the week. So how do you guys think the college football playoff rankings were presented to the fans this year? And would you guys make any adjustments? Dustin, I'll go with you first.
Yeah, you know, it got to be kind of what I thought was pointless there towards the end. Because you've ranked these teams 1 through 4, and essentially there's so much time to see so many changes. I mean, we're talking about Mississippi State and Ole Miss, who became irrelevant virtually at the end of the season. So, and Ohio State, who came, I think, in their first rankings, if I remember correctly, were slated at 16th or something like that. I don't know if they have any other way to go about that with ESPN and the contracts and people demanding to know some of this information. I don't think it's necessary. I think it gives the fans something to talk about. It gives us something to talk about. It gives us something to write about. I don't think it will be changed. I don't necessarily think it should be changed, but I wouldn't be upset if it went away. I'd like to see it prolonged a little bit, maybe wait until, I don't know, maybe around Thanksgiving or maybe the week before, when you're heading into those final 2-3 weeks of the season, you got the conference championship, and then really let the debate settle in, because there was just a lot of unfinished business left on the slates for a lot of those teams when they first announced the very first rankings on that Tuesday. So it'll be interesting. I think there's not going to be any change because, like I said, the TV deals and the demands from invested fans will want to know where their team's slated, what their chances are of getting to the playoff. But, you know, ultimately it's 6-1, half a dozen to the other. So I think it'll stay. It doesn't need to be there, but I'm not upset with how they handled anything this year.
Yeah, I pretty much agree with that. I think it was a little annoying to have to wait 3 days to really get rankings out, which, you know, there was nothing on Tuesday nights. They wanted that TV ratings, and people watched, people tuned in. Alex, you think Jeff Long is the best guy for that? Is there somebody else you'd rather see, or you think would do a better job of sort of communicating to the nation, or are you good with the re-election?
Yeah, well, I mean, being a fan of the game, Colin, I mean, I should have more of an opinion regarding operations, but I'm really okay with the whole Jeff Long thing. I think as fans, we tend to get a little bit spoiled, but, I mean, these guys do try their best. They're the ones that are in the office doing it. They can't please everybody, obviously. I mean, you're going to have a 1-4 system this year coming out. You're not going to be able to please everybody. You're not going to have, you know, people that are happy, fan bases that are always happy. You're not going to have a teams that are ranked 5, 6, and 7 in their fan bases saying, you know what, yeah, we deserve to not be in it. So I think they handled that pretty well, and Dustin said it pretty well too. I think it was just a little bit irrelevant coming out the rankings a little too early. I think that the whole having it on Tuesday kind of just extended the whole college football period as far as giving the fans something to chat about during the week when they could have had it, you know, say on a Sunday night. So I think they just kind of went away with the Thursday, Friday, Saturday football games and then tried to give the media and the public something to talk about through the middle of the week. So I was okay with that. But as far as the rankings, it just came out a little too early. It's always nice to know where your team stands. But like Dustin said, Mississippi State, I mean, they were irrelevant at the end of the season after being number one for a few weeks there. So I would like to see it maybe start beginning of December, those last few weeks, just to kind of get a sense of where everybody belongs, but nowhere near in the middle of the season where teams that, you know, could pretty much fall out of the rankings with a few losses. So,
Yeah, I think the big takeaway is just that so much of this is TV and ratings and all of that. And along those notes, you also have these reports that a couple entities want the college football playoff to change the dates. They're planning on having the semifinals on New Year's Eve in 2015, this next season. And ESPN knows they're going to have to compete with all these New Year's festivities. There's talk that the NFL might expand the playoffs and sort of push into the college football playoffs time. So it could come down to, one, some sort of cat fighting between these two pretty name brand entities, but also it's sort of tradition versus money and viewership. Dustin, I was really torn between this because I can see both sides. Are you on the side where you want that tradition back for New Year's Eve and college football, or does it make sense to sort of have college football work around viewership in the NFL so that it can have, you know, an audience that's focused on it that day?
Well, I'll just start by saying I've never been a huge fan of college football on New Year's Eve. Now, I don't mind the afternoon games, but when you get to the evening games, I just can't imagine that the ratings are too high at that point, just because this past season, I'm not even remembering what game it was, because I was out somewhere, you know, celebrating New Year's Eve. So I can't imagine that game got too high a ratings.
I think it was Georgia Tech, Mississippi
Georgia
State.
Tech.
It was something along those lines. So I've never been a huge fan of it going that late in the evening. However, I was a big supporter of the college football playoff and ESPN not backing down, because I think you get yourself into a slippery slope with this. If you back down to the NFL now, what are they going to expect from you later on? Who knows down the road? I mean, you got two really big brands out there. College football is one of the biggest, and then obviously I think the NFL is one of the biggest markets in all of sports. So I think it's good for the college football to not budge from where they stand on this situation. And if the NFL, I mean, competing the NFL and college football, it would hurt both ratings, but I think it's going to hurt the NFL more. Just because if you're talking about college football playoff games, when you've got four teams as opposed to a wild card game in the NFL, with depending on who's playing in it, you know, if it's Jacksonville and Tennessee, you know, you could end up not having very high ratings. So I think it was good for the college football playoff to just hold strong, not back down, and kind of set the tone with the NFL and say, hey, we don't care who you are or what you're doing. These are our dates. We're sticking to it, and you're just going to have to work around our schedule.
Yeah. I mean, I for one, I mean, the past two New Year's I've had, 2 years ago I was in the Georgia Dome when the clock struck midnight, and then this year it ended a little bit earlier, so that meant I was just at my computer writing a game recap. So I think anybody in the media would love for a little bit of time there, but I mean, I don't know if that's going to happen. Alex, do you think that they should just do away with sort of that late night game on New Year's Eve? Is it, you know, going to be easier just to have it on either the first or the second, kind of like they did with the BCS?
Yeah, well, even touching on New Year's Day, I mean, you had a game featuring Alabama and Ohio State, and you're talking about a game that didn't even get over until, I want to say, it was midnight Eastern, where some of these people that are trying to watch the game who may have gotten the New Year's Day off have to go back to work the next day. So, I mean, you're pretty much taking away two of the biggest games on New Year's, and you're pretty much just throwing it away, having a game ending at, you know, say 12 or 12:30. I'm a tradition guy. I really do like the New Year's Eve bowls. I do like the New Year's Day bowls. But I think with people these days, with how big of a joke the NFL has become recently with all the media outlashes, stuff with Goodell. I mean, you can see the even on social media, you see it all the time. You can't watch an NFL game without people, you know, hashtagging fire Goodell and stuff like that. And I think it's just gotten a little out of hand. So as a college football fan, I'm fine with it. I don't want to try and be a hero and say, you know, keep the tradition, because this is a money-making business. And I think the older you get, you realize how big of a business this is. So that's where I pretty much stand on that point. I'm not going to try and be a hero and say that we need to keep the tradition. So whatever fits works.
Yeah, yeah. It'll be interesting to see who wins that, because I really think this is going to turn into sort of a cat fight between the college football playoff and ESPN and the NFL. So it'll be entertaining nonetheless. So the national championship game, it was Ohio State, Oregon. I thought an interesting thing about that game was you had two programs that kind of take this approach to recruiting that it is completely national, and clearly any program you know, that is competing for national titles can go and get recruits just about anywhere in the country. But there are different philosophies out there. Ohio State, Oregon, Urban Meyer, Mark Helfrich are very national guys. They a lot of times go outside of the state. Whereas kind of in the past, and I mean, a team like Bama is not in the past, definitely, but Bama, USC, they're those teams that recruit so heavily from the Southeast, or if it's USC, a team like that in Southern California. Do you guys think this is a trend where in order to compete now, teams are going to have to go, you know, for a majority of their recruits outside of the area and not just in the region, or is it just sort of happenstance that it was those two teams this year? Dustin, what do you think?
Well, you know, I was interested when you know, the topics, and I was doing some research today, and, you know, you brought up two really interesting teams, and two teams, from what I look at from a recruiting standpoint, very differently, because Ohio State, even though we know Urban Meyer isn't afraid to go outside of his comfort zone and outside the Midwest, most of his guys, I'd say half, as I was looking through the roster, at least half, up to 60% were from the state of Ohio, and then the half of what was left over of that 90 to 100 man roster, half of that was Midwestern guys. So you're talking about Illinois, Kentucky, Indiana, even, you know, you can go a little bit east and say Pennsylvania and New Jersey. They got some speed guys from California, from Florida and Texas and things like that. So they can recruit out there. But then you look at Oregon's roster, and it's the exact opposite. I mean, you got plenty of guys all over the West Coast. They're reaching far east. They're going to the Midwest. I think it really just depends on what style of football you're going to play, because obviously the style we see in the SEC is you're wanting to recruit those bigger guys. And so you find that in the South, and you find that in the South and the Midwest. So that's kind of their comfort zone with those players. Whereas the West Coast, you're seeing more of the pass-heavy offense, speed guys. You're wanting guys that can get off the offensive quick, defensive line quick. So that's why you're going to see a lot more diversity in those type of rosters. I don't know if there's one way that's better. You know, history tells us it's going to be the teams like the SEC, Big Ten, just based on the national championships. Those type of guys are going to win you the big games. But it just completely depends on what your style of play is and how you're going to go out and get those recruits.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you, on that note, you have to remember that especially in places like Texas and some in California, there are programs where you play 7-on-7 and it's this wide open game, and a lot of those guys are going to want to go to a place like Oregon, whereas if you're Bama trying to play a more physical game, and you know, clearly we saw this year it's not just the SEC that has physical football, but generally speaking a lot of the bigger guys are going to go there, and then you have maybe these 7-on-7 guys wanting to play in something a little bit similar, like an Oregon offense. Alex, with National Signing Day coming up February 4th, this coming Wednesday, do you think that a place like USC, where it's this traditional power, you also have places like Michigan, which really struggling right now getting recruits, do you think they're going to sort of haul in guys from around the country, or is it going to stick with kind of like Dustin was saying, regionally, they're going to have to stay there in order to sort of haul in these recruits?
Yeah, well, I think it all depends on niches and pipelines. And, I mean, for example, SEC, obviously the reason they're so dominant is because of their recruiting. If you just look at the region, I mean, if you take states like Florida, Georgia, the Carolinas, Alabama, LSU, or Louisiana, sorry, you can get guys from all over the place. Guys from Florida can go to Carolina, vice versa, and stuff like that. Guys down there, the athletes that are the 4- and 5-star recruits, they can pretty much pick their poison with whatever state they want to go to. They're not solely based on whatever state they're from, based on where they're going to go to school. However, if you have a conference like the Big 12, I mean, if you think about it, they can pretty much just fill up their roster with guys from Texas. Teams, the middle-tier teams from the Big 10, say Iowa, say some of these teams like Minnesota, some of these middle-of-the-pack teams, I wouldn't be surprised to see them reach more towards the guys down south that are maybe thinking about ACC schools, or some teams that are thinking, or some guys that are thinking American Athletic, some of these guys that can't necessarily play in the SEC but may opt to go to the Big Ten rather than go to, you know, say a Conference USA school. So I think it all depends on pipeline. I think if you look in the West Coast, USC, obviously, with their tradition, is always going to get recruits from around the nation, but some of these teams from the West Coast may vie for, you know, some of these guys that that could be top-notch players at, you know, from Utah, or some guys from the Mountain West. So I think it all depends on just pipelines and, you know, I talk about the SEC, and you can pretty much pick your poison down there. Athletes from down south, they can pretty much go to wherever they want to. So that's my take on that. I think that, you know, with all these schools changing and the prestige kind of changing, it's going to be hard for some of these teams to get recruits. And I know we will be talking about Michigan and Harbaugh, so I got a few good points on that as well.
Yeah, good segue there. it'll definitely be an interesting it'll be an interesting week, definitely. With Michigan, I believe they still have just under 10 recruits right now. They picked a couple up at the Wisconsin-Michigan basketball game, or at least they announced it, sort of Harbaugh at the Michigan-Wisconsin game. I was really hoping when I turned it on and saw Harbaugh at that basketball game that they were going to try and get Spike Albrecht to, you know, come play some slot receiver. I have not heard reports of that yet, but I would support it. Dustin, how long, given that this recruiting class, at least right now, is a very small recruiting class, people sort of expect it to be Michigan, Ohio State, you know, immediately in 2015. How long is it going to take for Harbaugh to turn around this program? He's turned around just about everywhere that he's been. How long do you think that time frame is, though, with Michigan?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that, and I think we talked about this, you know, when it was announced that Harbaugh was going to have the position a couple weeks ago when we were still with incorporation with today's Pigskin. But what I think is it's going to be 2 or 3 years before he gets this program headed on the right track. Certainly, I don't think this is going to be a situation where he came in at Stanford, where I think he won 2 games his first season. This is going to be a growing process because the guys he had at Michigan, Brady Hoke's recruits, weren't really that talented, and they weren't the kind of guys I don't think that Jim Harbaugh is going to want to recruit. He came in late into the game. We got to remember that. So he's definitely behind the eight ball recruiting. And there's not a whole lot of guys when some of these other coaches are out recruiting and know their staff and know who's going to be the head coach. It's awfully hard to go out and convince a young 18-year-old kid to come to your university when you don't know who the head coach is. So even though it's Jim Harbaugh at this point, yeah, you can get up some of the guys that may still be deciding, and you may be able to make some good visits with some top recruits that are still available. But it was just so late in the game that I'm not surprised he has such a small recruiting class. I think the recruiting class then for 16, 17, and 18 will be much better, and I think we'll see the progress there. I think Michigan starts competing for the Big Ten East and competing with Ohio State in that last game of the season, meaning something in 2017. I think they're about 2 years. This will be definitely a rebuilding year, maybe make it to a bowl. The following year they may get up to 8 or 9 wins, and then after that I think you're going to see the two powerhouses collide between Urban Meyer and Jim Harbaugh.
Yeah, I think that's pretty fair, especially, you know, a lot of times in coaching it's sort of that they get 3 years and everyone talks about year three being a big deal. So if he can do it in essentially 2 seasons, that would be pretty well ahead of schedule, even for a guy like Jim Harbaugh. Alex, are you thinking it could be quicker than that? I know you had a great article, Q&A, with Ty Isaac, the transfer from USC this week, because they do have some guys coming off of transfers when they sat out last year, do you think it could be quicker than that, as in something surprising or something major next year, or is it a longer process, like Dustin was saying?
Yeah, well, Dustin pretty much took the sloppy handwriting right off my notebook. I pretty much have right here, I will give Harbaugh this year, and I hope it is 2 to 3 years in sloppy handwriting. I have that down. Jabril Peppers will make an impact next year. I'm really hoping Ty Isaac, obviously being a high school teammate of mine, I really hope he succeeds. It's just so weird, guys, because back a decade ago, my brother played at the University of Michigan, so I was privileged to go see a lot of the games at the Big House. And we're talking about a team in the Lloyd Carr era that was pretty much expected to be in the BCS Bowls and to win Big Ten championships and to hopefully make it into the national championships. But the mediocrity over the past few years is just really deflating, no pun intended, obviously, with everything going on. But it's just sad. It's sad to see such such mediocre talent, if you can say that about Michigan teams, and it's just so not like their program. But in Jim Harbaugh's benefit, Ohio State winning the national championship the previous year was probably the best thing for him, because now he can tell these guys, look what the Big Ten can do. We can hang with people to win national championships. And obviously to have Jim Harbaugh at the helm as an alma mater guy doesn't hurt at all. So like Dustin said, 2 to 3 years, I really hope Michigan fans are patient right now as far as rebuilding. And, you know, Harbaugh can't come in and just throw a team together and plan on winning the national championship. It's going to take a few years to get some of these guys developed. And I would love to see the Urban Meyer, Jim Harbaugh rivalry go on for a few years, but it's definitely not going to happen this year, and I don't think it'll happen next year. So by 17 or 18, expect Ohio State and Michigan to be up there.
All right, so it sounds like a little patience is needed in Michigan there. But Jim Harbaugh definitely has to be the biggest name hire in college football in the offseason. There's been actually a lot of movement, especially we had a lot of offensive coordinators move around, seems like more so than defensive coordinators. The one that was talked about a good bit this week was Dan Enos going from Central Michigan to Arkansas, really trying to get that offense going, because Arkansas really, I mean, you could have pretty easily made the argument by the end of the season they were a top 20 team and playing in that SEC West, which had a tough bowl season. But, I mean, that team was really coming around in the second half of 2014. Who are some of the best play callers you guys think could surprise next year? Could be Dan Enos, could be another one. But who are some guys / offenses we should keep an eye on next year that could surprise in 2015? Dustin, what's your call on that?
Well, I looked more in depth at maybe some of the offensive coordinators that had become head coaches. And, you know, a couple names, Phil Montgomery from Baylor to Tulsa, not really a step ahead, but he might bring something to Conference USA. But there's one guy, and in particular, that I thought did a phenomenal job state, and that's Jim Bowleman. You're talking about a team who I believe was in the ranked 40s or 50s a season ago in offense. I mean, they really weren't that productive. They depended on their defense a lot, obviously. And this year, the offense really picked up the slack where the defense left off. They were one of the top 10 teams in the country in scoring. They provided a stable attack on the ground and through the air. And, you know, this is just the second season there. So a bit of a surprise, because I know personally I didn't think Michigan State was going to have the offense. I thought it was going to be the defense that would carry them eventually to the college football playoff before the season started and before they ran into the really good Ohio State team. So that's going to be an interesting one. Obviously, we're going to look and see how Tom Herman does, the Ohio State offensive coordinator, and see how he does at Houston. I think he could do some really nice things with the Cougars down there. But, yeah, there's a lot of really good guys, I think, that are taking over as head coaches. It'll be interesting to see how they do with all the pressure on them as head coaches rather than just taking on the offensive coordinator role.
Yeah, I mean, I think if at the beginning of the season, if you had told me that Michigan State and that offense would come back from 21 points down in the fourth quarter against the top five team, I would have called you absolutely crazy. So I definitely agree with that call. Alex, are there any teams or guys, teams like Michigan State this year that could do something and really surprise and sort of complement a defense that way?
Can you repeat that, Colin? I'm sorry, man.
Are there any offenses that you think will surprise this year in addition to, or kind of the way Michigan State did this year with Connor Cook and especially that bowl comeback there?
Yeah, well, you know, one thing that I'm looking at this year that I think could make some noise, and I'm not saying that they're going to, you know, make a splash out of nowhere because their offense has always been good, but a team in Texas Tech, I think if you look at that conference with all the quarterbacks leaving, I know Cliff Kingsbury's got a lot of good stuff going on there. He's getting a lot of recruits. From what I hear all the time is that Cliff Kingsbury is one of the best coaches in the nation as far as, you know, pretty much just with team camaraderie. And obviously being in the Big 12 and in the state of Texas, it's going to be hard getting recruits. But I'm really anxious to see how Lane Kiffin approaches this season. If you look last year, obviously with Amari Cooper, they're losing the Blitnikoff winner. They lose pretty much their only dual threat quarterback in Alabama history. So that was a little bit unorthodox. And Dustin, you and I both like LSU next year to make some noise. So I'm really excited to see if Alabama can reload like they do every year with all this talent, or if it's going to be, you know, back to being defensive minded when you lose a guy like Blake Sims and you lose a guy like Amari Cooper. So my team to watch obviously would be Texas Tech. And then I'm really excited to see if Lane Kiffin and the offense can repeat what they did last year, kind of getting away from that defensive first minded team and seeing if they could put points on the board like they did last year.
Yeah, there's no love I'm hearing from, and I agree with all that, but I'm surprised nobody's thinking Jim McElwain in Florida. I mean, if you can do anything other than hand the ball up the middle or run the ball up the middle with the quarterback there at Florida, I think they're going to be pretty happy over there with the Jim McElwain offense. But one little last section here we'll call this section the Hail Mary section. Today we're going to talk about Hail Marys, but I think it's something we should continue sort of a quick shot at the end. This year, it seemed like there were so many more completed Hail Marys at the end of games, especially in the Pac-12. You had USC going down to a Hail Mary. You had Cal going down to a Hail Mary. The Bahamas Bowl, there was that ridiculous play. Is this a trend? Is it a coincidence? Is it something that, from an X's and O's standpoint, defensive coordinators should look at differently? What happened this year with all the Hail Marys? Dustin, do you think some adjustments need to be made in terms of the way teams are defending Hail Marys at the end of the game?
Well, first, let me compliment Alex, because that was a great point on Lane Kiffin. I don't think he gets enough credit for the job he did at Alabama. I think people hear the name Lane Kiffin and just scoff at it or display it, but a good point there by Alex.
Nope. Thank you, Dustin.
regarding the Hail Mary, I just, you know, people defensive coordinators get so, I don't even know what the correct word would be, but they get so scared in those, or get tentative in those last minute or 2 minutes of the game, and teams are able to drive and get down to their own 40-yard line with, you know, 5 or 6 seconds left, and at that point, you know, you've got your quarterbacks at this level can get the ball to the end zone, so then it's just a jump ball, really, at that stage, and the receivers we're seeing now are bigger, they're faster, they can jump higher than some of these smaller defensive backs. So it's not a coincidence, I don't think, that the offense is starting to win a lot more of these jump balls. What I think needs to happen defensively is they need to put more pressure on the quarterbacks, because you see sometimes their defensive linemen that just stand there, they might be two or three front, and they're not putting a heavy pressure on the quarterback. I think if you just weren't so relaxed in that last possession of the game, you'd see have teams on their side of the 50-yard line or the 30-yard line, and then they'd have to get into those desperation-type modes. And then to another point, I think, you know, the offenses are just practicing it. I don't know if – and Alex might be able to answer this playing the game. I don't know if defenses plan for situations like that as much as an offense does. You know, I know there's certain plays that you run in at the end of practice and say, okay, this is our final heave play, or this is our hook and ladder play, or our lateral play. I don't know if defenses run a specific play or set of plays or prepare for that in practice or not. I'll let Alex talk about that, since, you know, he's been on the gridiron and I haven't. So, but I think it's no coincidence that when these lack of defenses are coming out, teams are getting to their 30, 40, 50-yard line, the quarterback heaves it up there, and big, strong, talented receivers are coming down with it.
Yeah, that's a great point. I hadn't even thought about that. That, you know, it could be something that offenses might, I don't want to say take more seriously, but might practice more, you know, as part of sort of that end of the practice 2-minute drill. If you do that, might as well practice a Hail Mary or two as well, or at least what you do in those situations. Whereas defense is sort of like just put four guys on the goal line and, you know, every 20 yards after that, so you cover all the space. Alex, do you think it's something that's practiced less by the defense? Could that be true? I mean, it seems like it'd be surprising, but I mean, it's a great point.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you think about it, you just have a coach telling the secondary, hey, guys, go ahead and bat the ball down. But if you're a defender and you see a ball literally coming right to you, your first instinct is just to catch it and pad your stats. But the thing that surprises me most is that it's not even that coincidental, because I think if you looked last year, the Nebraska Northwestern game, that was just a great bounce. I mean, Jordan Westerkamp caught a tip and was pretty much a foot in the end zone to win on a Hail Mary. But I don't know if you guys remember seeing the USC Arizona State game. Jalen Strong caught the ball with nobody around him. I mean, it was almost like catching it. It was almost like catching a deep post, like a skinny post, and there was nobody around him.
Yeah.
It wasn't a jump ball. He caught the ball clean, and you could almost say the same thing about the Arizona Cal game, which is funny because I do know a guy who had a 5-team underdog parlay, and Cal was the last game to win, and he lost in a Hail Mary. It was something like $20 to win $1,700, and he lost on that Hail Mary. But I just think it's the motivational factor of these defenders thinking that, yeah, we have six or seven guys back here against four, and then sure enough, you know, the offense comes down with it. I think it's just a mental lapse, and it really is weird. I don't think it's coincidental, but it wouldn't be a college football season without all the drama. So it's almost like the football gods are just putting it in the hands of the offense. But the thing that surprises me most is that USC Arizona State game, how you can leave a wide receiver so open. I just don't get that. So if you're a defense, then this is the perfect year to watch film of exactly what happened the three occasions this year and try and stop that, because a team that has one play to go 60 yards should, let it be realistic, should never put the ball in the end zone, especially when you're pretty much double-teaming everybody. So,
yeah, that was a tough night for me as a USC grad, so I was mostly just bringing that up to try and hope Steve Sarkisian was listening. Maybe we can give him some pointers on that Hail Mary defense. But thank you guys for calling in today, helping out with today's U College Sports Talk. It's Alex, and you can get to him on Twitter and multiple times a week on Today's U. His Twitter handle is AlexK_47. And also Dustin, Twitter handle sharpshooter, sharp_SCHUTTER. Thanks, guys.
Appreciate it, Colin.
Thanks, Colin.
Sure thing. All right, let's get going with some college basketball here. Is this Bobby here?
Yeah, hey, Colin.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
Doing pretty well. Let's see, it looks like we have Bev as well. Hey, Bev.
What's up?
How's it going?
Dude, doing fine. How's everybody? How's everybody else?
Doing all right. Doing all right.
So
getting
ready for the
Super Bowl.
Dude, it's always a good thing to get ready for. I've watched Marshawn Lynch's incredible interviews probably 5 times today.
Yeah, I mean, you can really just watch it on repeat, about, you know, 4-second clip, and just watch that one response on repeat. So we had Coach K this week is the big story in college basketball. Gets 1,000 wins. Bobby, you had a great column on sort of what 1,000 wins means, both right now and sort of long term. Where do you think Bobby, Coach K, stands right now? I know you sort of respect him so much, even if you're not a Duke Blue Devil fan. But where do you think he stands in sort of the greatest coaches in college basketball ever, whether that's comparing to a Wooden or somebody of that magnitude? Do you think he stacks up with the top coaches in college basketball or even possibly sports?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to go sport to sport. You know, you can't really compare him to,
right,
like a Chuck Knoll or or even a Nick Saban in modern-day college football. But if you're looking at basketball, and again, generations are different and eras of basketball are different, but, you know, everyone talks about Mount Rushmore. He's definitely on the Mount Rushmore of college basketball coaches. You know, he's probably second, maybe third. I'd probably give him second. Wooden's still the best, in my opinion. Just that how dominating his teams were, and again, you just look at how many titles he won. That I 1,000 wins is great, but again, looking at titles and just the dominating force Wooden had, and he was kind of the first or second great coach when you think of college basketball. You think of him and Adolph Rupp as kind of the first two that come to mind for most people. But yeah, it's Clyde Krzyzewski kind of right there in that number two spot behind Wooden.
Yeah. I think it's interesting because so many people are like you, or they really aren't Duke fans, but they, you know, you can't help but respect Coach K. I know Bev, we both spent some time at Wake Forest, and there, the game you want to win the most is against Duke. You know, you do not like this Blue Devils, but you can't help. Yeah, Carolina's right there too, but you can't help but respect Coach K. So what is the feeling in that area
switch.
In terms
of it's funny how they switch to Wake Forest? Because my dad's a Wake Forest grad, and for him, it's NC State.
Wake Forest can't make up his mind in terms of a rival. It's an issue.
Yeah, that's true.
When he was there, it was Albano at NC State.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. So Bev, do you think the general sentiment there is, man, I can't believe that Duke is doing so well, but we like Coach K, or is it more supportive now of Duke in general because of Coach K?
What do you mean, like among Wake fans or like people in North Carolina? What
among ACC schools right now?
Oh well, you got to respect Coach K. I mean, you know, I mean, as Bobby was saying, you know, when it comes to Wooden and Coach K, it's kind of hard to pick. I mean, they're both so incredible, different ways. I mean, you know, obviously Coach K has done the whole Team USA thing, which is great. But you know, I think I could coach, you know, Team USA because we're just so much more talented. Nobody's really ever said that, so I figured I would just say that. But yeah, I think everybody respects Coach K. I mean, I think, you know, Steve Lavin for St. John's and the whole crowd, you know, even at the St. John's game after Duke came back and beat them, you know, they had a good moment for him after the game. And, you know, you can hate Duke, but if you hate Coach K, it's because you refuse to, like, love Coach K. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, more of a jealous.
Because you get too many passes.
What's up?
I hate Coach K because he gets too many passes.
What do you mean too many passes?
Imagine if another coach sent assistant coaches to do all that on-floor, in-game interviews. Coach K is the only one that gets away with that, and people don't care.
Yeah,
imagine
true.
If that was someone like Calipari.
People imagine
would
if
have
it was Marshawn
Lynch.
Back.
Coach K needs
to
employ Marshawn Lynch. There's your soundbite. I guess the takeaway would be that no other coach has 1,000 wins, but I get what right. you're saying there. He sort of gets a pass from the average sports fan. But
well,
he's going to go he's going to go for win 1,001 tonight against Notre Dame. It's going to be two teams that are great on offense and defense. And it really just depends on the night. You know, they can show up or not show up. So, Bobby, do you think one of these teams, Duke and Notre Dame, is more vulnerable than the other because of their defense? Or is it really, you know, we've seen Duke lose early in the tournament pretty recently. Are both sort of those vulnerable teams down the road because of spotty defense?
I mean, Notre Dame's a lot more vulnerable than Duke because of their defense. Duke's actually, I'm trying to remember, I saw the stat when I was messing around on KenPom the other day. I think they're actually a decent three-point defensive team, it's everything inside, or they get beat, which would make a little bit of sense. Notre Dame, though, they just don't have any size or depth. I mean, if they go, what, 6 deep, maybe 7 deep, and one player over 6'8", that's where they're going to get hurt.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's going to be an AAU game tonight. There's going to be zero defense
play. Yeah.
That's fine, because that's how they want to play. I mean, that's completely fine. You know, throw Iowa State in the 3-team there, and it's going to be incredibly fun to watch. But Notre Dame just not having that size. I don't know how you match up with Okafor and Jefferson and the emergence of what has to be like the 13th Plumlee brother. I mean, you send three of them out there. Again, Connaughton's been great for Notre Dame. Obviously, Jerrion Grant's been is an All-American. But you're asking Pat Connaughton to try to guard Emile Jefferson or Justice Winslow.
Yeah, it's not happening.
That's kind of pushing it there. Yeah, what happens when – I'm going to butcher his last name, but Zach August gets in foul trouble because they're just going to feed Okafor tonight and play for him.
Yeah,
That's where Notre Dame's going to get. That's where Notre Dame's going to be vulnerable, whereas, you know, Duke has the depth and the size to kind of make up for their defensive efficiencies.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, it'll definitely be a pretty fast game going up and down the court. Both those offenses like to get out and run. Bev, what do you think? What's the over under for this game, and who you think's gonna come out with it? I'm guessing you're going with Duke, seeing as you agree with what Bobby was saying there.
Yeah, I'm definitely going with Duke, and I mean, even though it's at Notre Dame, you know, I don't really think the home court advantage. I actually think Duke may win by like 15 points. I just think they're better. And, you know, and as Bobby already explained, Notre Dame has absolutely nothing inside, and Duke is, you know, stacked down low. I think Notre Dame, you know, hangs on for a little while, and then maybe in like the last 10 minutes, Duke just pulls away. Because, you know, it's Duke, so they're also going to make a bunch of, you know, three-pointers that probably shouldn't even be attempted but will be made. And I think Okafor dominates down low. Nobody can stop him. Although it will be interesting to see how aggressive Okafor is, because this should be a game I think Okafor should put up, you know, 18 to 24 or 5 shots. And, you know, I mean, he's shooting a great percentage. He's scoring a lot of points, but, you know, and I could be wrong, but it doesn't seem like there are many games this year where he's really been a volume, you know, scorer in terms of putting up a lot of shots and really kind of pounding it down low.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of, especially with being a freshman, he's been a pretty efficient scorer down low, and that's definitely the most polished part of his game. Yeah, he has so many moves down low and can score in a variety of ways. So we know Notre Dame's going to score at 85 points. So if Duke's going to win by 15, does that mean they're breaking the century mark in this ACC basketball game?
No, I think they get to like.
I'm kidding, but they could happen,
well,
though.
Okay. Hey, dude, you never know. These teams don't play defense. I think it'll be like 87 to like 72 or something. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. So on the other end of the spectrum in terms of offense, defense, we have another hot team out there. As much as I don't love this team because Shaka Smart turned down Wake Forest this past offseason, VCU is playing really well. They have that havoc defense. And they're really flying up the rankings. They could move into the top 10 pretty soon here if they do keep winning. Bobby, do you think VCU is a team that could be a Final Four contender? They've been there before. Is it a team that a lot of people in their brackets are going to have in the Final Four, or is this a 12-game winning streak and they'll sort of come back down to earth later in the season?
I think it's a happy medium between the two you just said. Could they make the Final Four? Absolutely. The year they made it, they did it obviously by getting steals, you know, forcing turnovers. They were also a better shooting team than people remember. this year's team is mm-hmm. the best offense that Smart's had at VCU. And he has the senior leadership with Briante Weber and Trevion Graham. So could they? Yeah. I don't think they'll be, you know, the trendy pick as like a 3 seed that people have going into the Final Four. You know, what's weird with VCU, though, is they're based all on matchups. You know, if they play a certain team, a certain style, where if they can't score, they don't get to set up the press. So when they're playing, you know, a better defensive team, that's where you kind of struggle. That's where you saw on Friday night where they struggled with St. Louis. They didn't score the ball, so they couldn't set up the press. So, you know, it's kind of in between of what you said. You know, I think they're kind of where they are, the 12th best team in the country.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that the Havoc defense might not be quite as good this year as some of the past teams we've seen, but the offense is better, so that probably balances
right.
out. But Bobby, I'm gonna go back to you with this one as well, because I know how you feel about another team in Virginia, in the Virginia Cavaliers. You're not very high on them. What is the best team in Virginia? Is it VCU or UVA?
Mary Washington, Division III.
Oh, my God.
I knew you'd find
Amazing.
A way to avoid that one.
I got love for Mary Washington. I've had good times in Mary Washington.
I almost went there. But I think it's still Virginia. It's not by much, but I think it's still Virginia's, you know, better. And obviously they have the head-to-head matchup against them, so that kind of disputes an argument right now. But, yeah, you know, I think Virginia's definitely still better than VCU.
All right.
Where do you think UVA is?
Something.
Yeah. Where do you think UVA is in, like, the top 10?
9. I don't think they're an Elite 8 team. I have them at 9.
Oh, my goodness.
Their ceiling, the way they play, their ceiling is a sweet 16, so they can't be any higher than 9 in my mind.
Wow.
So, Bev, I'll give the same question to you, and I think I know what the answer is. Do you think Virginia is the best team in Virginia? And if so, do you think it could be something where maybe both VCU and Virginia make some noise in the tournament, or is VCU kind of that Sweet 16 range as well?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I obviously still think UVA is the better team. I don't think UVA, you know, I mean, they played like crap against Virginia Tech, arguably the worst game I've seen them play. And, I mean, they ended up winning, but it was just terrible. But, you know, with VCU – like, I like VCU. I love the way they play. I love Shaka. I think he's incredible. But, yeah, I mean, I think they're a Sweet 16 team. I think that some good teams would have to lose in order for them to, you know, make it to the Final Four. I definitely don't see them in the Final Four. I see them maybe getting to the Elite Eight, but definitely not the Final Four.
Yeah. And I mean, March Madness, it's all about. Go ahead.
Oh, no. I mean, pretty much what I was going to say is that I don't think they're going to, you know. I just don't think they're good enough. I haven't seen anything that shows me that they're good enough to be in the Final Four. I mean, I mean their best wins this year have been like who they beaten this year is really good. I mean, I know they won at St. Louis the other night in a close
yeah.
game, and I know they got killed by Villanova. Sure.
Right.
And beat Northern Iowa.
Yeah, they have
what was that,
a couple
Bobby?
Decent wins.
Beat Northern Iowa.
Oh, yeah, I like Northern Iowa. I have them.
Which, yeah, that's a good win. But I think it is true that in March Madness is going to come down to those matchups. So, you know, if it lines up and they have a pretty clear path to the Final Four, they could do it. You could also see them, you know, just sort of playing to seed or even getting upset. It really just comes down to matchups. So we'll have to get to that much closer to March. But Bobby, you were talking this week in one of your articles saying that, you know, you think UVA is going to come up short in the tournament. And short, not just the tournament, but that they're really going to slow down this year. They have a really tough week this week. They play Duke, Louisville, and UNC. Let's say, just hypothetical, let's say they win two of those games. They suffer their first loss of the season, but they also get two quality wins. Do they earn more respect for you? Do they break into your top eight with two quality wins? Or once they lose, you know, it's the beginning of the end for them?
Yeah, I wouldn't. I mean, they get two of the three at home, so they should win the home game.
Right.
You know, I think they go 2-1 over the stretch. I think they lose at Carolina. I'm torn between if they go 2-1 or 1-2. I think they beat Louisville, but I'm torn with them against Duke. If that's in Chapel Hill, or if that's in Cameron, then I think Duke wins. You know, no question. And I think they lose at Carolina. I mean, no, they're not going to crack my top eight because of everything that's going on with them. I've said it from the very first article on today's, what was today's Fast Break when we wrote on there, that they were the worst top 10 team. Now, here is Florida, but, you know, that they were my flop.
Yes, Florida's definitely taken that spot.
Right. But I don't think
they're not
good. I don't think the way they play, they get past the Sweet 16.
So, Bev, I'm guessing that your prediction for the week is a little bit brighter than that for the Cavaliers. Are you expecting them? Do you think they can go through this week undefeated, or is it a loss and they're still one of the top teams?
Yeah, you know, I'm actually kind of with Bobby in that. I think they win at home against Duke. I think they win at home against Louisville. And crazy enough, I think they could win at UNC, but I think they could actually lose at NC State after this three-game stretch. That may sound insane, but NC State's playing well at home. They have some big wins at home and have other games that should have been big wins at home that they choked away at the end. But, I think – UVA played terribly against Virginia Tech. They're not going to play that badly against Duke at home. They're just not. I think they're going to win that game. I think they're going to play good enough defense down the stretch, and I think I think they're going to shoot well enough at home to win that. I think it'll be close. It'll be really close, low scoring. At UNC is hard because UNC is good. UNC is playing well recently. Like Justin Jackson, that freshman is really a good player. He's playing well. Obviously, Marcus Page is Marcus Page. Nate Britt was making jump shots the other night. I thought the world was ending. I didn't know he could do that.
I guess I wouldn't be surprised if they went 3-0 over this next stretch, over the stretch, because I definitely think they're good enough to go 3-0. I definitely think they go 2-1. I don't think they go 1-2, and they sure as hell aren't losing on 3. and if they do,
I will be the happiest man in the world.
Yeah.
Yes, and I will not be.
Yeah, Bobby will get back on next week and just laugh his whole way through podcast. I think that right there, when Bev started out saying he agrees with Bobby, is the first time you two have agreed on Virginia on anything this year. So we're making progress.
Yeah.
And I'll agree with you, Bev. I think that NC State game is a dangerous game. Back in the preseason, I did a top 25 rankings, and I had NC State in the top 20, and they've made me look like an idiot the entire season, they're starting to come into form, and I think they will eventually get there. So moving towards March, and as we start going over all the bracketology and trying to project the brackets, Bobby, who do you think will be the four number one seeds. I'm guessing you're not going to go the two ACC teams route with a UVA and Duke or something like that. But if you had to guess right now, who are you putting in those top seeds?
Right. I think there's too many good teams this year that no conference is going to have two. So I think, you know, projecting end of the season, I kind of have two. Projecting end of the season, you know, it's going to be Kentucky, Gonzaga, Duke, and I'm going to say Arizona. And then,
yeah, it's really a toss-up after really the last couple.
Right, you know, it's going to be something between Wisconsin's going to be in that talk, Kansas is going to be in that talk, I think. And then, you know, if Utah wins the Pac-12, do they get the one seed? But there's just too many good teams, you know, the kind of branch. You know, if March Madness started tomorrow, your one seeds are looking a little bit different, where obviously Virginia would be a one seed right now.
Right.
Kentucky, Gonzaga, and, you know, if it's right now, Duke probably gets that second one seed, but they still have to play each other at the ACC tournament. You know, there's too many variables. So that's the kind of thing how I think it's going to happen. There's going to be about 8 teams, 9 teams playing for those 4 one seeds.
Yeah, yeah. Bev, are we going to have 2 times in a podcast when you agree with Bobby and think that there won't be any conference that has 2 one seeds? You thinking anybody could do that, or what's your top 4?
Well, I my 2 locks for number 1 that I think, you know, I don't think Kentucky's going to lose, and I don't think – I mean, Gonzaga is not going to lose a game until the tournament. I mean, they play in an easy conference. They're going to run through that. They're going to run through the conference tournament. I mean, even if they have a slip-up game, they're going to win every game. I mean, they're just so much more talented than anybody else in that conference. And with Kentucky and Gonzaga, you know, I think Arizona, because I think Arizona is just really, really good. I think they're going to win the Pac-12. I like Utah, but I think Arizona is better. And, you know, for that last spot right now, I mean, it'll be an ACC team, but I think it's, you know, it's going to soon get to that time where teams start beating up on each other. I think UVA has an advantage because UVA hasn't lost any games that they shouldn't have lost. And then and Duke has lost, you know, a couple games that they should have won, including getting blown out at home by Miami. I still don't understand how that happened. Miami's good, but they're not that good. I mean, I would have to go Kentucky, Gonzaga, UVA, and Arizona. I also think with the possible exception of Gonzaga, I think those are the 4 best teams right now. Yeah. I do think Gonzaga's really good. A couple different plays, and Gonzaga would probably be looking at a undefeated regular season.
Right.
Go ahead. I was going to throw in maybe Wisconsin, because Wisconsin's just really talented.
Yeah.
And you got Frank Kaminsky, who's a beast. But sorry, go on. I'll cut you off.
I mean, they have 3 guys who could be All-Americans, and that's tough to compete with. So I think you're both right. There's going to be probably 8 or 9 teams, whether they're 1 seeds or they're 2 seeds, that have a great shot at going all the way to the Final 4 and beyond. But thank you guys for helping out today, being on the Blog Talk Radio. And everybody can read them multiple times a week, just about every single day, actually, for the 2 of you. And find them on Twitter. Bobby is at UKLefty22. And Bev on Twitter is #BevNeedsATwitter. So if we get that trending, maybe he'll get a Twitter account. But thanks, guys. And hope you have a good night and enjoy the Duke-Notre Dame game tonight.
Always fun.
All right, thanks, guys.
See y'all.
Bye. See ya.